Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on story time when we come back. Hey, are you concerned about your privacy? And how much does your government know about you anyway? And how much do you want your government to know about you? Well, government only knows as much about you as you tell them about yourself. And everything the government industry or business knows about you is because you told them. Now, the Fourth Amendment protects us in our persons, houses, papers, and effects. But it does not protect us from ourselves. Now, can we have privacy in the computer age? Well, you bet we can. And that's because information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. It's knowing how this information is gathered and what information is being stored and what information you and I want to keep personal and private. That actually puts us in the driver's seat in our quest for privacy. So always keep in mind that no one knows anything about you or about me that we haven't revealed by our own hands or our own mouths. Now, if you'd like to learn more about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call and ask for my free general law CD package? It's a 4-hour program, and it's entertaining, it's informative, it's educational, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order one right now. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email, send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, story time. From time to time, I like to tell a story or two about what happened to illustrate a point. There are many stories that we hear throughout our lives, and I'm getting to be an old man now, and I've heard a story or two, and these stories oftentimes can be very helpful in helping us to avoid the pitfalls of having to reinvent the wheel. Now, most people cannot learn from other people's mistakes or from other people's successes. My old daddy explained it to me this way. He said, "Son, experience is the best teacher. There's no substitute for experience. And when you learn from the school of hard knocks, you will never forget it." But, he added, it's a god-awful hard way to learn. So he gave me a piece of advice, and he said, "Now, son, the next time you want to do something, it may or may not be foolish, but if you'll come and run it by me first, I will tell you how it worked out when I did it." And then I said to him, "Yeah, but you know, you lived a long time ago. And the things that we do today, you probably never thought of." And my dad assured me that there wasn't anything that I could think of that he had not already done. Now, I was probably 10 or 12 years old, and I wasn't quite sure that my daddy knew what he was talking about. So I mulled that over for a while, and one day my Uncle Carol came in. And he asked me if I had a slingshot. You know, I was 10 years old, and I said, "No, sir, I do not have a slingshot." So he said, "Well, let me show you how to make one." So my Uncle Carol went out, and he cut a fork, a crotch out of a tree, And he came in and he worked on that, and I watched him, and then he went out and got an old inner tube and he cut off a couple of long strips of rubber, and then he took a tongue out of an old shoe, an old leather tongue out of an old shoe, and he made the pocket for the slingshot. And then he got some string and he punched holes in the rubber and he attached the pocket, and then he attached it all to the fork, and he made this wonderful slingshot. I mean, it was the slingshot of slingshots. Well, sir, I took my slingshot and I went out and I fired it off a few rounds, and boy, it was as good as it looked. Well, I was the proudest kid on the block. Well, I had that slingshot in my back pocket, and I came in the house one day. And my dad saw it hanging out in my pocket. Now, I didn't stick it in my back pocket for no good reason. I wanted my dad to see it because I was really proud of it, really proud. And so he said to me, he said, boy, he used to call me boy. He said, hey, boy, come here. And so I came over, and he said, what do you got in your back pocket? And I whipped it out, proud as a peacock. And then I showed him my brand new slingshot that Uncle Carol had made me. Well, sir, I was standing there watching, and old dad looked at it, and he admired it. He said, why, son, did you make this? And I said, no. And I said, no, Uncle Carol made that for me. And he said, I should have known. He said, your Uncle Carol makes the best slingshots. There's nobody that can make a slingshot like your Uncle Carol. I've made slingshots, he said to me, but they were never as good as Uncle Carol's slingshots. And he said, when we were kids, my Uncle Carol would make a slingshot and I'd make a slingshot, and Uncle Carol could hit a bird and I could hardly shoot it. He said, you're very fortunate to have a slingshot that your Uncle Carol made, because, son, there is nobody that can make a slingshot like Uncle Carol. Boy, I felt good. I had the finest tool that money could buy. It didn't cost me anything. Uncle Carol made it for me and gave it to me free of charge. And my dad said, now, son, you need to take that slingshot and go throw it in the garbage. Did you hear me, boys and girls? My dad said, you need to take the finest tool, the finest slingshot that could be made by God or man, and throw it in the garbage. Get rid of that thing. And I said, but why? You admitted yourself that it was the finest slingshot that could be made by the hand of God or man. And he said, it is. I don't deny it. He said, but son, you're just going to get into trouble with that. You see, you're going to go out and you're going to break windows with that. And you're going to have to pay for every window you break. Well, if that's your only concern, Dad, you can rest assured that little Georgie Gordon will not go out breaking windows. I'm too smart for that. After all, I'm 10 years old or 11 or 12 years old, you know. You know, I'm no dummy. So my dad said, well, all right, you know, let your conscience be your guide. But I want you to know that you're going to have to buy, you're going to have to pay for every window you break. So he went back to reading his paper. You know, this is in the days before television. We didn't have TV. We had newspapers. And so my dad, you know, he's laying on the couch reading the paper. So some time went by. I don't remember exactly how much time went by, but some time went by. And I came in the house, and as I was walking through the front room, my dad, you know, he said, hey, boy. And my dad used to call me boy, you know. And so I said, yes, sir. And he said, I've got a bad report about you. And I thought about that for a second. Now, you see, when I was a boy growing up, nobody ever lied to his dad. Well, not and lived to tell about it. So there was kind of a rule, you know, that said, if you're going to lie, you might lie to anybody, but don't ever lie to your dad. So When my dad said he had a bad report about me, I said, well, who gave you a bad report about me? And he said, let me ask you a question. He said, is it true that you broke some windows with the slingshot? Now, I had to answer that question. I had to answer it pretty darn fast because, you know, if I stalled around too long, the old dad, you know, he's going to get wise to, hey, this kid's lying to you. I'd learned that a long time before when I'd lied a couple times before and got whipped real bad. So I had to make a fast decision. Should I lie about this or should I tell the truth? And I said, well, I might have broke one. He said, well, that's what I heard. But he said, I heard it was more than one. And I said, well, maybe it was two. And he said, son, I heard it was more than two. And I said, well, I don't know how many it was. So he said, let's go get in the car and go take a look at them. So we went out and we got in the car. And he said, where do you want to start first, son? So I said, well, I guess we ought to start down at the Christian church, down at 11th and H Street. He said, that's the only, I said to him, I said, that's the only place I broke any windows. So we drove down to the Christian church, and he said, where are these windows that you broke? And so we had to go across the street to the Veterans Memorial Building. So we went over there, and they had two cannons from World War One. Well, maybe one of them was from World War Two, but one of them was a World War One cannon, and that was the one that I was hiding behind. See, the bushes had grown up around it. And around the cannon, they had these rocks. They'd poured gravel, you know, down there, kind of like a pad for this cannon to sit on. And those rocks were just perfect for my slingshot. I mean, you couldn't get better rocks than that. I mean, they must have been sorted, you know, went through a screen or something to get all the right size rocks. They're all just the right size. And boy, would those rocks sail. I could fire them clear across 8th Street. I mean, I must have been, you know, a couple hundred feet back, you know. Here I was safe in the bushes. Nobody could see me. I could pick up those rocks. I could fire them across the street, knock them windows out, just one right after another. And nobody could even see me back there in the bushes. Hell, I could do it at high noon with both hands. Didn't even need a road map. Well, the church over there was a fine target. It probably had, oh, I don't know, maybe 100 windows, just little panes. They weren't too big, you know. And it was stained glass. And these stained glass windows, now fortunately for me, as it turned out, they weren't leaded in glass windows. They just putted, you know, but they were stained glass. And they were rough on one side and they were smooth on the other. And they had different colors to them, you know. That got a little pricey as time went on there, you know. Some of them were blue and some of them were amber and some of them were this, that, and another thing. Fortunately for me, of the 11 windows that I busted out, 9 of them were amber and only 2 of them were blue. Although they had some red and other colors in there. Those 2 blue and 9 amber panes of glass, they weren't too big. They were probably about 6 by 8 or 6 by 11 or something like that. You know, they're just panes of glass. So anyway, my dad said, well, let's go over and talk to the people at the church. We went over and we looked around a little bit and we found a caretaker. The caretaker identified the preacher, so we went over and talked to the preacher. And the preacher didn't even know the windows were busted out. See, they were up on top of the church, up high up. And although the windows had been broken out, nobody had ever seen the glass on the inside, which had landed, you know, on a loft or a balcony up high up in the church. Now, he said they did notice that there were rocks in the church, And they were really mystified as to where these rocks were coming from. So he'd actually saved some of those rocks, and he showed them to my dad. He had the prima facie evidence right there. But of course, now he's got a confession right from the culprit. And so we told the preacher, you know, my dad did what had happened. And so the preacher, he was very understanding, and so he said, well, he'd have the maintenance man look at it, and my dad said, well, I'll do one better than that. I'll have a glass man come out and measure those windows up for you, and I'll have those replaced, and then we'll just pay for it, and he'll make arrangements when you have time, you know, and he'll come in here and he'll fix that. And the preacher, he just tickled pink, you know, that here's a guy comes over, knocks on his door, says, hey, we caused you some damage, and we're just real sorry about that, and we're going to fix it for you. And so my dad went home with me. He said, now, son, are there any other windows besides that church? And I said, no, there wasn't. Just that church. That's the only place I busted any windows. So he gave me the job. You know, he didn't do it. He said, now, you go down there to the glass man. Now, see, I was a paper boy at the time, making $47 a month, delivering newspapers. And so my job was to go down to my glass man down at about 7th and G Street, I believe it was, 6th and G, something like that. Had a little glass shop down there in Eureka, California. So when I broke a window out, you know, in a house accidentally, you know, that happens, you know, you throw in a paper and you bust a guy's window, you got to fix it. And so he'd already fixed 3 or 4 windows for me. And so I went down to him and I got some broken windows, and I don't know exactly how many, but it's up at the Christian church. And it's up in the top of the church, you know, that big kind of, looked like a fan, you know, it was kind of an arch that went around. And now, I didn't get any of them up there in the arch where the glass is actually curved. It could cost a little more if you got to cut a curve. All the windows I busted were square or rectangular. And so he went out and he looked at it, and I came back a few days later, you know, and I said, how much is that going to cost? He said, well, there's 11 of them. He said, no, 9 of them are amber and 2 of them are blue. He said, they're all puttied glass. And he said, I'm going to put all those windows in. He said, how'd those windows get busted, son? And so I told him, and he kind of chuckled a little bit, you know. Now I don't know what the real value of those windows were, but he charged me. He asked me, he said, how much money do you make in a month? And I told him $47 is, you know, about, you know, on average about what I make every month. And he said, you know, those windows are kind of pricey. He didn't use the word pricey. He said they're pretty expensive windows. They're stained glass. And he said, son, you don't know how lucky you are that those panes weren't leaded in, because they've been leaded in, which most churches, you know, they spend a lot of money putting those leaded glasses in. He said, now, if you'd have got a mosaic, you know, like Jesus and the Virgin Mary and, you know, something like that, and there was actually artwork up there and you broke some of those out, he said, I'd fear to tell you what that would cost you. But he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, I will put those in for $47. Now, I don't know what those windows would have cost had it been a real job, you know, but he said he'd put it in for $47. Now, I've got to work a whole month for nothing to pay for these 11 windows. So I didn't have any choice, you know. You're going to put them in, and that's the end of that argument. You know, God had spoken to me already. And so I said, okay, that sounds good to me. And so he went out and did the job, and I had to pay him $47. And that month, as I recall, I didn't quite have 47. I think I was a couple dollars short. So I had to pony up a little money out of my savings. I had the $47. That wasn't a problem. But he gave me terms, you know, I could pay it off at the end of the month when I'd finished my collections and got my money all together, and so I paid him. Well, there's the story of little Georgie and the slingshot, see? Well, the deal was done, and I was about 11 years old at the time, and some years went by. And one day, my dad, I grew up and got to be a big kid, you know, left home and one thing and another. And one day, my dad and I were sitting in the blue room having a beer. I think I might have been 21. I kind of forget now. Yeah, I had to be 21. I was drinking beer, and in California in those days, you had to be 21 to drink. So yeah, I was 21. I might have been 22. I wasn't married yet, and I got married at 23. So, you know, I'm just a young shaver, and so we're sitting in the blue room. We're sipping on a beer, and we're chit-chatting a little bit, you know. And while we were talking, I said, "Dad, do you remember years ago when I was delivering newspapers, and I had Uncle Carol's slingshot. Remember that slingshot he made for me?" And he said, "Yes, sir, I remember that." And I said, and do you remember you said to me, he said, "Now you take that slingshot and you throw that in the garbage." And he said, "Yes, sir, I remember that. Remember that." And I said, "I didn't throw it in the garbage. And I told you that I was very responsible and I wouldn't cause any damage." And he said, "Yes, sir, I remember that." And I said, "And then you said you're going to go out and break windows with that." And then he said, "Yes, sir, I remember I told you that." And I said, "Now, Dad, how did you know that I was going to go out and break windows with that slingshot?" And he said, "Well, let me tell you the story." And he said, "It's about time for you to hear this story because you're a Gordon, and my granddad told me this story, and he told me that his granddad had told him that story, and this goes back several generations now in the Gordon family." And so he said, "We were living in Fortuna, and I was about your age, and I had a slingshot that I'd made, and my granddad said to me," that's your granddad, he said, "it's my dad, but you know, your granddad said to me, he said, 'You take that slingshot now and you throw it in the garbage, because if you don't throw that in the garbage, you're going to break windows.'" And my dad said to me, he said, "I didn't listen to him any more than you listened to me. And sure enough, I went out and broke some windows." And some time went by, and granddad asked me, we called him Pop, you know, and he said, "Pop called me in, and he said, 'Now I got a bad report about you.'" And so I asked him what the bad report was, and he said that he'd gotten a bad report that I'd been out breaking windows, and he said, "I want you to take me out and show them to me." And so I took took Pop out, and I showed him the windows that I'd broken. So he made me work and get the money and pay for them. And I was about your age, probably about 10, 12 years old when that happened. And he said, "I grew up, and then I got to be about 20 or 21 years old, and I was sitting there talking to Pop one day, and I asked him the question. I said, 'Now, Pop, you remember years ago when I was just a little shaver, I had a slingshot.' And he said to me, 'Yes, sir, I remember that.' And I said to him, I said, 'Now, you told me to throw that slingshot in the garbage, and I didn't do it.' And he said, 'Yep, I remember that.' And so I said to him, I said, 'Well, do you remember that I went out and broke some windows, and you asked me the question, did I break any windows, or that you'd gotten a bad report? Didn't ask me if I broke any, but said, I got a bad report that you'd broken some windows and made me go out and show you where they were.' I said, 'Yep, I remember that.' And he said, and I said to Pop, he said, 'I said, how did you know that?' And he said, 'Well, I'm glad you asked me now that you're growing up, because when I was a young boy, about 10, 12 years old, I went out and made a slingshot. And I was real proud of it. And my dad asked me, he said, what do you got there in your pocket? And I said, it's a slingshot. And he said, throw it in the garbage. And I didn't. And he said, you're going to go out and break windows with that. And when you do, you're going to have to buy and pay for all the windows you break. And he said, I didn't listen to him. And I went out and broke some windows. And sure enough, he asked me the question. He said, I got a bad report about you, and I'm gonna require that you take me out and show me the windows you broke. And so he did. And so my granddad, who's talking to my dad now, he said, how'd you know that? And so he said, well, sit down, son, let me tell you the story. And when I was a boy, my dad said to me, take that slingshot and throw it in the garbage. And so evidently this had been going on for several generations in the Gordon family. And so I asked my dad, I said, now, what makes you think that over the last several generations, us Gordons are always going to go out and break windows? And he said, son, a slingshot is for breaking windows. They don't serve any other purpose. Can't hit a rabbit, can't hit a bird, no good for hunting. The only thing they're good for is busting the windows. And he said, you're going to have a son one of these days. You're going to get married and you're going to have some children and your boy is going to make a slingshot. And when he does, you tell him, throw it in the garbage. Because you're going to go out and bust windows with that. And he'll say to you, oh, no, Dad, I won't break any windows. And so you give him about 3 weeks or a month and then you call him in and you say, son, I've got a bad report about you. Well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. It's been that way in our family for the last four generations, five now, with my boy Ted. And yes, sir, my boy Ted, he went out and broke some windows just like I did, just like my daddy did, just like my granddaddy did, and just like my great-granddaddy did. And I told my boy Ted the same story. I said, you know, son, someday you're going to have some children, and when you do, your boy's going to come in with a slingshot when he's about 10 or 12 years old, and your job is to tell him, throw it in the garbage. Hey, we're at about the halfway point, so I've got to give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement, and the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the law or an editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. You know, some years back, I used to fly a lot, and we probably we were probably at Barrister's Inn back in the early 1980s, I'd say between 1980 and 85. We were probably traveling around the United States at about the rate of $30,000 to $40,000 worth a year flying on airlines. I wasn't the only guy there flying out, but Bob and I would fly around, and sometimes Jim Hill would, and we'd go out and talk to people, various audiences, and hold seminars in schools and one thing and another. And we had a travel agent there in Boise, Idaho, and the travel agent, you know, they're good. I like those travel agents because if you wanted to go, let's say, to Detroit, Michigan from Boise, Idaho, and you got to figure out, well, does United Airlines, which flies in and out of Boise, Idaho, do they fly to Detroit? And sometimes they don't. I mean, you know, you gotta get on United Airlines and fly to San Francisco, then you gotta get on an airliner from San Francisco, maybe American Airlines or somebody else, to get to Detroit or Miami, Florida or Dallas, Texas, or, you know, it could be Springfield, Missouri or Springfield, Illinois. And so you've got a schedule to make, and those guys, they're pretty good at that, you know, they can. And then there's the cost involved. You know, the airlines, they have different prices, and so the travel agent, he could save you a lot of money. We discovered that pretty fast. And so our travel agent, you know, he'd put us on various airlines, and I mean, you could get on United in Boise and shift over, you know, to American in Denver, and then you could be on Ozark Airlines, and then you could be on the East Podunk Airline, and you know, you might have three or four changes, you know, to get to what little town you wanted to get to, you know, like Harrison, Arkansas, or something on that order. So we used this travel agent, and we were pretty happy with him. And then we had another little program, and in the program, you'd call us and you'd say, well, we'd like to get you or Bob or Jim or somebody to come out here and speak to our group in Buffalo, New York, or Dallas, Texas, or wherever you happen to be. And so we required that you send us a round-trip ticket. Now, you had to pay us a speaking fee also, you know. We don't come out and do it free, but you know, there's a requirement that you send the ticket. It doesn't have to be first class or anything like that, but got to have a round-trip ticket. And so a fellow by the name of Marvin called me from Kansas City, and he said, you know, we've been listening to you, and we're kind of interested in you. We have a group of people out here, and we'd like you to come out and speak to us. And so I said, well, Marvin, here's the fee, and you got to send us a round trip ticket. And he said, well, what airline do you like to fly on? And I said, oh shucks, you know, we fly on any airline, whatever's cheap. Doesn't have to be first class, you know. You can put us in coach, or you can put us down in the baggage compartment, or wherever they got space for us. And he thought that was a pretty good idea, and so I said, just call me and tell me when to go pick up the ticket and what counter. And well, out of Boise, Idaho, as I recall, I don't remember exactly, but I think there was only two airlines that flew in and out of there. I think it was Frontier Airlines and United. Now, there might have been one or two others that I don't remember now. It's been a long time ago, but I do remember Frontier, and they were based in Denver, Colorado, and then there was United. I don't know where they're based out of, but United, you know, was the biggest airline in the country at the time. And so I said, well, the two airlines that fly in and out of here, you know, are Frontier and United, and if there was a couple of more, I probably told him what they were. And I said, whichever one's cheapest, and you know, that can get me over to Kansas City, why, that'll be fine. And so a couple days later, he calls me back and he says, now, Mr. Gordon, I have bought and paid for your tickets here in Kansas City, and you'll be flying on Frontier Airlines, and your flight leaves Boise, Idaho on June 13th at 4:30 p.m. and arrives in Kansas City, Missouri at about 9 p.m. at night. And we'll be there at the airport to pick you up and take you over to your hotel. And I said, well, that's pretty good. And so he said, you just go to the Frontier Airlines ticket counter and tell them who you are, and your ticket will be waiting for you. So the next day, which was the day I was to fly out, I got to the airport early. Hell, I was probably there by, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock maybe. I don't know exactly. It was kind of my custom in those days to arrive at the airport early, go up to the lounge, have a couple drinks, eat. You know, typically have a lunch or something like that. And I like to eat in the restaurants, you know. So I arrived at the airport and I walked over to the ticket counter and I said, my name is George Gordon. And there was this wonderful lady behind the counter. She was so friendly and so helpful, as airline ticket personnel used to be in the old days. I assume they're still that way today. I don't know. And I said, my name is George Gordon, and here at this ticket counter, I have been informed by my client in Kansas City. And his name is Marvin You-Know-What, and I gave her his name. And I'm on flight 37 that leaves at 4:30 this afternoon and arrives in Denver, Colorado at 7. And then we leave Denver at 7:30, and we arrive in Kansas City at 9. And then there's a return on Monday, and it flies back. And I gave her all this information. I mean, he told me, and I told her the exact connections and the airline and the whole nine yards. And she reached out, and she pulled the ticket out, and she says, yes, that is correct. And so I said, well, I'm here to pick up the ticket and I'll be on today's flight. And so she said, that's wonderful. Now, do you have identification? Now, you see, boys and girls, even back in those days, I didn't have a Social Security account, and I didn't have a driver's license, and I didn't have a marriage license, and I didn't have a birth certificate, and so the answer is, no, I don't have any identification. And then I paused and I said, well, yeah, I guess I do. And I reached in my pocket and I handed her my business card, you know, which said George Gordon, Barristers Inn, and had our address and phone number on it. And she says, oh, no, Mr. Gordon, this is not satisfactory. You have to have two forms of state-issued ID, such as your Social Security card, driver's license, passport, state identification card. And I said, ma'am, I just want to fly from here to there. And my customer has sent you the ticket. You have it right there in your hand. I don't have any identification. And my business card. Now listen, I could do this. If you're concerned about who I am, I will call my office. Better yet, you've got the phone number right there. Just call my office and tell them that they can send somebody out here who can identify me. And she said, no, it's company policy. You have to have two forms of state or government issued ID. I'd never heard this story before. You know, this is about 1983 or 82 or 84. You know, it's a long time ago. It was before 9/11. It was before the Patriot Act. It was long before Homeland Security. It was when we still had, America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, and we had some reason, logic, and common sense. At least I thought we did. But she said, no, two forms of state-issued ID. Now, I'd been flying around for a long time, boys and girls. Hell, I was 40 years old. By 1983, I was 42 years old. You know, I was kind of an adult type by that time. And you got to remember, no, I'm flying all over the United States regularly. I'm flying, you know, I've been to places like New York City and Miami, Florida, and Dallas, Texas, and Detroit, Michigan, you know, I thought I was a pretty well-traveled kid. And I'd never run into this before. First time for me. And so I said, well, what do you propose to do? And she said, well, if you don't have identification, I can't give you the ticket. Now, I was pretty surprised. Now, I've been flying in and out of Boise for several years, and I'd never been on a Frontier Airlines plane that was full. In fact, I don't ever recall being on any airliner flying in or out of Boise, Idaho that was full. There's always extra seats, you know. So, you know, with that little piece of information, I said, now your airliner isn't going to be full tonight when it takes off, is it? And she said, no. So there's going to be at least one seat in there that I could fly on. And she said, yeah. And I said, okay, let's do this. I'd asked her already. I said, why do you have this policy? And she said, well, the policy is put in place so that people don't come in here and claim tickets that aren't theirs. Now, evidently, Frontier must have had somebody come in there and claim a ticket and get a free ride. Once, maybe twice. I don't know. But maybe that had happened to them. And I don't blame them. You know, it's like a damn shoplifter, you know, in a Walmart store. I don't blame the Walmart people for being upset and having somebody at the door checking your ticket as you walk out and counting the merchandise that you've got in your basket. I think that's reasonable. I'm not complaining about Walmart, you know, and they're checking me. And I'm not even complaining about Frontier checking to make sure, you know, that I'm the real George Gordon picking up the ticket. But I don't have any ID. But I thought with a pretty good deal. I said, you know, you take my business card, says George Gordon on there, Barrister's Inn. You call that phone number, and I think you're going to get my office. And if you get my office, you're going to get the receptionist, and you're going to say, is there a George Gordon there? No, he's out at the airport. What airline is he flying on? He's flying on Frontier. Everybody at the office knew where I was going and where I was going to be. And they could say, well, where is he going to fly to? And I think they would have said Kansas City. Can you tell me who his client is in Kansas City? And I'm pretty sure everybody knew it was Marvin so-and-so. And so I think that would have been pretty good evidence that I was probably the real George Gordon. But I said, I asked her this question. I said, well, has any other George Gordon come up to the counter today and asked for this ticket? And she said, no. I said, well, then I'm the George Gordon that's probably the guy you're looking for, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go over and sit down, and I'll wait until 4:15, and when they get the final boarding call, it says, you know, last call for flight 47 or whatever it was, and nobody has come in and claimed that ticket yet. And I'll come over and I'll pick it up, and I'll say, well, I'm the George Gordon that you're looking for, because if you think that I'm the phony George Gordon, then the real George Gordon should be in here before that plane takes off, because, you know, he's the guy that's designated for that seat. And she said, no, that's not satisfactory at all. You have to have two forms of state-issued ID. And so I was beginning to think that maybe there wasn't any reason, logic, or common sense. And I didn't blame the ticket lady, because she was probably just as stupid as she was educated to be in the public school system. But the thing that amazed me is that the management of Frontier Airlines would put that kind of policy into place, especially in the days when there was competition. Of course, there wasn't a whole lot of competition. It was either Frontier or United, I guess, out of Boise, but... So I said, well, I'm going to go sit down over here. I didn't have anything else to do, you know. So I went over and I sat down, had a couple of drinks, you know, up in the lounge and puttered around the airport for an hour or so. And then I went over and sat down. And sure enough, at 4:15, they called the last call, you know. I rushed over to the counter and I said, okay, now has there been a George Gordon come in here and claim that ticket? And she said, no. By now, she's not nearly as nice as she was when I was first approaching her. In fact, she was pretty surly, pretty nasty, pretty snotty, and acting like a pure anus erectus. So I paused right then, and I went over to the window, and I watched the Frontier airliner close the hatch, be pushed back, and I watched for about 15 minutes as it taxied down the taxiway, and got to the end of the runway and took off, and I watched it disappear into the eastern sunset. Well, it was the it was the sun setting in the west, shining on the airplane in the east as it disappeared into the clouds, headed east. Well, sir, I went over and I called my office and I said, missed the plane. Everybody's really shocked. Miss the plane? Well, you're out there 2 hours early. How could you miss the plane? Did you get drunk in the lounge? So I told him what had happened, and I said, give me Porter's number, would you? So I got Porter's number, and I called him. I called him on the telly, and I said, now, Mr. Porter, I missed my plane, and I told him the story. And he was kind of dumbfounded, and I said, well, I guess I'm not going to be there. So he said, well, now, listen, Mr. Gordon, you know, we got all these people going to be here now tomorrow night. And we kind of need you here, you know. And so I said, well, I hear you. Now, I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. There's another airline here. It's United Airlines. Let me go over to United Airlines and see if I can buy a ticket on this end. And since I saw you had the ticket here, and I actually saw the ticket, I know you bought and paid for it, and so you're not trying to stiff me. I said, well, I'll tell you what, it was $350, as I recall, and I didn't have the money in my pocket. I mean, I had a couple of bucks, but I didn't have $350. So I had to call the office and have them send somebody out with some money. But in the meantime, I went over to the United ticket counter, and I said, could I buy a ticket from you? And pay you cash money, pay in $20 bills. I want to fly from here to Kansas City. Could you do that? And she said, certainly, sir. We can get you from here to Kansas City. I said, terrific. But I got a real problem. I said, I don't have any identification. And she said, that's not a problem. We don't care who you are. I said, well, good, because I was just over at the Frontier Airlines counter, and if I don't have two forms of state identification, I can't fly on Frontier. She looked at me like I was suffering from the terminal stupids. I said, lady, it's a long story, and I don't want to get into it now. I'm just telling you that I couldn't get on Frontier, and their plane left here about half an hour ago, and I wasn't on it. Not a round-trip ticket. She thought that was a little peculiar. So I said, well, I called my office, and they're going to be out here in a few minutes, 15, 20 minutes, and they'll have the money. And write me up a ticket, and I need a round-trip ticket from here to Kansas City and back, and when can I get out here? And she said, you can get on the 9 o'clock plane tonight. Last flight out here is 9 o'clock, and you'll arrive in San Francisco at, 10, something like that. And then you can get on the 10 o'clock flight, or 10, 11 o'clock flight, I think it was, or something like that, from San Francisco, and arrive in Kansas City at 2:30 in the morning. And I said, well, that's a hell of a deal. All right, so I'm not going to fly from here to Denver and then to Kansas City. I'm going to fly from here to San Francisco and San Francisco to Kansas City on United. So I did, and so I got on the plane, and I went to San Francisco and went to Kansas City, and so that was the end of the story, and it was a very happy ending, and I made my engagement, and I spoke my piece and talked to all these people. But I wasn't happy with Frontier Airlines, and so while I was speaking to that audience, about 100 people there in Kansas City, I told them the story. And I said, I'd like to send a message to the Frontier Airline people, and I want to start here in Kansas City. I want to send them a message that deals with reason, logic, and common sense, and good business practices. I want all of you people in here to stop flying on Frontier Airlines until they change their policy. I want all of you people in this audience, whenever you fly, wherever you fly, make it a point to fly on any airline other than Frontier Airlines. Will you do that? Most of the people in the audience raised their hands and waved them and said, you bet. I said, one more thing I'd like you to do. Every time you go into the airport, if it's a Frontier Airline desk, I want you to stand in line and wait until you can get your turn, walk up to the clerk, and say these words. I would fly on Frontier Airlines, but I don't have any identification. Turn on your heel and walk away. Can you remember that? I want you to walk up to the Frontier ticket counter, and I want you to tell them, I would fly on Frontier Airlines, but I don't have any identification. Turn on your heel and walk away. I want all of you people to do that. Now, all of you people have 10 friends. Everybody has 10 friends. And I said, I want you to go out and tell 10 of your friends the story. Make it a point. Over the next year, I want you to go to your 10 friends and tell them this story. And then I want you to tell your 10 friends, who also have 10 friends, to tell this story to 10 of their friends. And then I want you to tell them to tell their 10 friends to tell their 10 friends that I would fly on Frontier Airlines, but I don't have any identification. Will you do that? These 100 people all raised their hands. Now, for the next year or two, I was out, you know, traveling around on United Airlines and Ozark Airlines and United and American Airlines and, you know, any airline but Frontier. In fact, I called my travel agent there in Boise. And when I got back from Kansas City, I got him on the phone and said, Bob, I said, we're going to be flying, and from now on, I want you to put us on an airliner, and I want you to save us money, just like you always have, but I don't want to fly on Frontier Airlines. And he thought that was crazy. And he said, why? And I told him this story. And he said, you should write Frontier a letter. I said, I have a 6-page letter. And I've already mailed it. But I said, I told him, I said, no, I'm just mad as hell. And I said, until I get satisfaction, I don't want anybody from Barristers Inn booked on any plane, any flight, anywhere, at any time, for any cause or reason on Frontier Airlines. Do you hear me? He said, yes, I hear you. I said, I don't care what it costs. If you're going to book us on an airliner that costs 2, 3, 4 times as much money to avoid Frontier Airlines, that's what we'll pay. And he said, I hear you loud and clear, Mr. Gordon. And I said, okay. And so that's what we did for the next year or two. Well, what kind of results did we get? So I would be out speaking to groups. I was probably out twice a month. That's 24 times a year, sometimes more often than that. And I would go into groups over a period of time, and I would ask them, have you heard the Frontier Airlines story? And sometimes some people would raise their hands. They'd heard the Frontier Airlines story. And so I would tell them the story. I always opened my seminars with the Frontier Airlines story. And then I would tell them, you go tell 10 of your friends, and always when you're in the airport, if there's a Frontier Airlines ticket counter, you always get in line, stand there, walk up to the counter, tell the ticket agent, I would fly on Frontier Airlines. Now, remember, I wrote them a 6-page letter, and I'll tell you why I kept the campaign up. Frontier did not even respond to my letter. You see, they must have passed this policy. And they probably didn't give a rat's rectum about what people thought about it, I guess. I don't know. Because ordinarily, you get at least a form letter. You know, when you write to the government, like Social Security, and you complain or ask them something, they at least send you a computer-generated form letter that says, too bad, sucker. They didn't even send me a letter and say, go to hell. That really ticked me off. So what was the result? Well, about 2 or 3 years later, Frontier Airlines filed for bankruptcy. Now, you know, I'm not as so pretentious as to say, see, I put them out of business. No, far from it. I don't know what put them out of business. I think that their stupid, asinine program, their own policies put them out of business. I just wanted to point out to you that little Georgie Gordon was busy throwing gasoline on their fire. And I was throwing gasoline on their fire in every city in America where I spoke to a group of people, whether it was 10, 100, or 1,000. I was there talking to them and telling them the Frontier Airlines story. And Frontier Airlines went out of business. And they deserved it. You couldn't heap any more disrespect on a company that deserved it more than Frontier Airlines. So, what's the moral to the story? You know, you and I have a whole lot more power than we give ourselves credit for, because you know you've got 10 friends. And when something egregious like this occurs, and you go tell 10 friends, it'll keep those 10 from buying from that vendor. Where it might keep 5 of them from buying from that vendor. Or shucks, it might keep just 1 of them from buying from that vendor. And that's better than nothing. Now, many organizations like Now and ACT UP and others, they actually have a lot of members, and they'll tell their members, and they'll tell the Chamber of Commerce, and they will tell corporations and others that if you don't follow our program, if you don't believe in practice, and if you don't do this or that, we will not buy from you. Well, you know, if you were to take the Benevolent Association of Police Officers and somebody said, whatever you do from now on as a police officer, don't ever buy a Colt firearm, that wouldn't set well with the Colt people or the Remington people or the Winchester people or the Glock people or anybody else. They want to sell guns. They want to sell their products. So when a company comes up with some asinine policy or program that you don't agree with, why don't you speak up and say, excuse me, is there any reason, logic, or common sense here? Now, I told this story, I assume, to the chief executive officer of Frontier, and I pointed out to him, I said, you know, that day I was the only George Gordon that walked up there. I was the only guy that could identify the itinerary and identify the guy that sent me the ticket. Normal people wouldn't be able to do that. I offered to have somebody from my office come in and identify me, and she turned me down. I said, you know, there were other alternatives to your policy, and you didn't take them. And it's for that reason that I'm taking my action. So I did, and Frontier went out of business, and I'm just as happy as a clam at high tide. Now, I have zeroed in on other corporations and others who have done this kind of thing, but I have never been dealt with like Frontier. Normal people, normal businesses want your business, and they will write you a letter and say, we're terribly sorry, Mr. Gordon, for that inconvenience. And sometimes, you know, in a restaurant, they'll even give you get a free meal free, and we're terribly sorry that this happened, and we like your business, and we want you to come back. I mean, normal people that have heads that screw on straight. And when you find one like Frontier Airlines, Studebaker, Hudson, and Packard, and Enron, those companies go out of business at some point in time, don't they? Dumb businessmen who initiate dumb policies end up with a dumb result. So there you are, boys and girls, the Frontier Airlines story, and never forget, you've got more power than you give yourself credit for. Hey, we're out of time. I'm going to have to break it off right here and remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Remember, the law hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.